Hi, I'm Whitney.
And I'm Camden. Welcome to Ghosts and Garnets.
Before we get started today, we just want to thank our newest patron, Travis Wohl. Travis, I hope I'm saying your name right. Thank you so much for your support. We hope you enjoy your early ad-free episodes.
And if you want to be as cool as Travis, you can try. We don't know. But you can head on over to Patreon and sign up yourself.
Yeah, do it. There's a link in the show notes. It says support the show. Anyway, welcome to Road Trip Hawaii.
Hawaii, come on, I wanna lay ya.
My husband is particularly excited about this episode because he is a Hawaiian man. And he's going to be so upset because we are going to butcher the absolute hell out of these names. They're very long.
But we're going to try our best. But yes. You guys have heard me before. It's never great. So you would think with having the German last name that I grew up with that nobody could pronounce right, that maybe I could get a name or two in here. But alas.
No, I cannot. It's difficult. I think it's just that there are so many letters. They're very long, you know. Hawaiian names. When I was pregnant with Poppy, Russ wanted to hire, apparently there are people like that you can hire in Hawaii who will make up a Hawaiian name for you, like Hawaiian people. It's like a tradition that they do. And so you essentially allow this person to create this name for you. And he was showing me some of them. And one of them, the first name was 26 letters long.
Okay, so that's a super cool tradition. It would be super neat.
I said, do you hate our baby?
Already? Yeah, she hasn't even kept us awake one night yet, sir.
Yeah, I said, no, Poppy it shall be.
And then he has his mother's name for his middle name, which...
Her middle name is Leilani. It is a Hawaiian name.
Hawaiian. Yeah. Yes, it's beautiful.
And so, yeah, it was after her grandmother. So anyway, but I thought that was very funny. And do you see what I'm dressed as today?
EMT.
Yep. I signed up for an EMS shift today, and I am going to Firebird Raceway for 6 hours for some race car driving.
I actually think like that's really interesting. Like it totally takes you out of your comfort zone to something that you, Whitney Collins Rivera.
Yeah.
Would not typically
even
spend a second thinking about going to. I think it will be fun.
Well, it might be fun. We'll see. It's beautiful outside, so hopefully it'll be fun. Last weekend, I did an EMS shift at Hemp Fest, and that was a real eye-opener. And the weekend before, I did a shift at this arena football at Idaho Center. It was fucking weird. I didn't even know we had that. I thought I had signed up for a concert. It was called The Horsemen. And so I was like, oh, that's just a band. I don't know. And it was at the Ford Idaho Center. So I was like, oh, yeah, it'll be a concert. Easy peasy. And I'm driving out there with my partner. And I was like, so what's this band? And she's like, what the fuck are you talking about? And it was like, the band. And she goes, it's a football team. And I was like, what? It's very strange. It's not like regular football. But anyway, yes, I'm expanding my medical horizons. It's hit and miss.
Well, listen to me. It looks like you've written a novel today. So let's get into it. So,
yeah. All right.
So we can get into it.
Okay. So this story is wild. I cannot believe like a lifetime miniseries has not been created about this. Or like even back in the 80s, like an NBC miniseries about that. This is fucking crazy, this story. So this week, we are talking to you about a case that was called the Massey Affair in Hawaii, and I had not heard of this. So this involves two very dramatic criminal trials, one for rape and one for murder, and both involving multiple defendants, and it forever changed the nature of Hawaiian race relations. Filled with twists and turns and unanswered questions, the trials have all the elements of a good mystery. The second of the so-called Massey Affair trials also closes out the courtroom career of America's greatest defense attorney, Clarence Darrow. No trials ever had a more significant effect on a state's history than those that shocked and shook Hawaii in 1931 and 1932. Named for the Greek muse of comedy, Thalia Fortescue, perhaps predictably grew up playing what she saw as harmless pranks. Her privileged social status had always afforded her the freedom to get away with mischief, whether it was driving an idling butcher truck around the block or wheeling a baby in its carriage down the street, unbeknownst to its mother, just some casual kidnapping. You know, pranks.
You know, pranks.
Thalia's mother, Grace Hubbard Fortescue, was the niece of Alexander Graham Bell, and her father, Major Granville Raleigh Fortescue, was the out-of-wedlock son of Robert Roosevelt, Theodore Roosevelt's uncle. And her mother grew up in high society in Washington, D.C., and she was obsessed with high society, and her attitude really did not help with Thalia's, I think, just baseline snobbiness and vapidity. She was not great. At the age of 16, Thalia abruptly married a man in the Navy, Lieutenant Thomas H. Massey. She was 16 years old. The romantic view Thalia had of becoming a Navy wife, a life that promised adventure and travel, wore off quickly. Despite living in an exotic locale, Thalia found that the numerous social engagements and polite conversations bored her. Used to doing whatever she pleased, Thalia often left parties abruptly, giving other guests the impression that she thought herself socially and intellectually superior. Her attitude had begun to take a toll on her marriage. When Thalia's actions became gossip at the Navy wives' bridge tables, Tommy threatened to send his wife back to her parents if she failed to improve her behavior. Thalia, sadly, had two miscarriages, which didn't help her attitude, and the marriage degenerated into heavy drinking and public fights. Thalia was essentially on probation with her husband, who wrote an informal set of conditions under which he would continue the marriage. Otherwise, he was going to send her ass back to her parents in Washington, D.C.
Being married or being a wife in the 30s sounds like it would have been a fucking wild ride. Like, no thank you.
I'm going to send you back to your mother if you don't change your attitude.
That's like he's raising his own child.
I'd be like, do it, bitch.
Yeah, do it, bitch, please. I'm so fucking bored.
This is so boring here. I'm only 16.
I'm so bored.
Yeah.
Tommy's threat of divorce did not stop Thalia from leaving a Navy party at the Alloway Inn in a snit on Saturday night, September 12th, 1931. The plan was to spend the evening at a nightclub on the outskirts of Honolulu's Waikiki district. Thalia anticipated the night would include another night of heavy drinking for Tommy and his submarine buddies. She didn't really want to go, but had a case of FOMO, and she decided that joining the party beat the alternatives. After an hour of chatting over bootleg liquor with two other officers and their wives, the Masseys left their bungalow, Manoa Valley, at about 9:30. They headed to the Alloway Inn, where Saturday night was dubbed Navy Night. 50 cents bought 4 hours of dancing until 1 a.m. Around 11:30, Thalia was in an upstairs room, agitated over the fact that Tommy had spent most of the previous 2 hours ignoring her. She slipped into the seat of a drunken submarine skipper who had left for the bathroom. When the skipper returned, he demanded his seat back. Thalia refused. The skipper called her a louse, and she responded with a hard slap to his face. Tommy was called to calm down his wife. It was just before midnight. Thalia, bored with the party, left the Alloway Inn and began walking down Kalakaua Avenue in the direction of the beach. Tommy, assuming that Thalia had found her own way home, hung around the inn until the party ended. Shortly before 1 a.m., Thalia Massey flagged down a car on Ala Moana Road. The passengers turned out to be two middle-aged couples and the son of one of the couples, all on their way to a late-night eatery. One of the passengers, Mrs. George Clark, recalled later that Thalia had a badly swollen face and lips and a gash on one of her cheeks. Her evening gown, on the other hand, seemed to be in good condition. Massey refused offers to be taken to a hospital, Clark said, and asked instead to be driven home, which she was. A few minutes later, Thalia answered the phone. It was Tommy calling from a friend's house. Quote, "Something awful has happened," Thalia told her husband. "Come home." When Tommy arrived, Thalia related a shocking story. Crying, she told Tommy that she had been gang raped by a group of Hawaiians.
About the same time that Thalia Massey jumped in front of the headlights of the car on Ala Moana Road, Agnes Peoples appeared at Honolulu's downtown police headquarters to report an assault on her at a nearby intersection. Peoples reported that after a near accident, a young Hawaiian man had punched her in the face, which in turn caused her to respond by punching him in the face. The license plate of the touring car that had nearly hit her, she told police, was 58-985. The police put out an all-points bulletin for the car and its occupants. 1 hour after Peoples filed her report, police got another call. It was Tommy Massey reporting that his wife had been assaulted. Two investigators were dispatched to the Massey house. When they arrived, they listened, stunned, to Thalia's story of having been attacked by four or five Hawaiians, dragged into some bushes, and raped six or seven times. Thalia described the car as old and dark-colored. She said she could not read the license plate and it was too dark for her to recognize faces, but she somehow knew they were Hawaiians. So two alleged attacks on women by Hawaiians within a very short time frame, you know, detectives were like, huh, this is probably just a single gang that's just terrorizing women around Waikiki. And so they were searching. And a search turned up the owner of a light tan Model A Ford bearing the license plate number that Mrs. Peoples had reported. The owner was an unmarried Japanese woman who lived in a poverty-stricken slum called Hell's Half Acre. Detectives quickly determined, after visiting her cottage, that the car involved in the Peoples incident had been driven that night by her son, Horace Ida. They hauled Ida to headquarters for interrogation as a suspect in both the Peoples and Massey assaults. So Thalia was brought into the hospital and examined, where the examining nurse described her as, quote, clean as a new pin, unquote. This is important. She was also brought into the police station where she was unable to identify Ida in a lineup. While she was at the station, she also overheard the plate number of Ida's car and suddenly remembered that she had caught a fleeting glance of the plate and gave them a plate number that was off from Ida's by just one number. So only a single digit separated the license Massey reported from the one that Mrs. Peoples had reported. And police were like, this can't be a coincidence. And it wasn't, because radio messages reporting the license number had been heard by members of the Massey party. In addition, a friend of the Masseys who went with Thalia to the hospital had been told the license number by a detective. Yeah. With the near match on the reported license plate numbers, investigators quickly jumped to conclusions. When Ida was brought into a room with Thalia Massey, a detective named McIntosh said accusingly, "Now look at your beautiful work." He said that to this kid. Under intense grilling and believing that he faced danger only in connection with the people's assault. So he was like, "I'm getting arrested because of what happened with that car that we almost got into a car accident with." So he revealed the name of his four friends that he had been with, because he didn't know he was there because he was... He actually thought that Thalia had been in the car and was one of those complainants. So in a matter of hours, his friends, Ben Ahakuelo, Henry Chang, David Takai, and Joe Kahahawai were taken in for questioning. The case was starting to look pretty solid to the police, but just to make conviction easier, Detective McIntosh urged another investigator to take Horace Ida's Model Ford truck and drive it back and forth in the mud at the clearing where Thalia Massey alleged that she had been gang raped.
What?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Jesus, fuck.
Yeah. News of the alleged rapes and the arrests outraged Hawaii's white community. Admiral Sterling, commandant of the naval district based in Hawaii, expressed the hope that the brutes would be strung up on trees. Sick. A banner headline in Honolulu's advertiser read, quote, "Gang assaults young wife." And the accompanying story told how a refined and cultured young lady of the highest character had been brutally raped by a gang of fiends. A group of white businessmen posted a reward of $5,000 for evidence that would help secure convictions.
This doesn't even sound like a true story. Like, it sounds like something made up because what the fuck?
Cam, we will get to the end of this and you will be like, I have never heard anything like this before. It just keeps getting crazier. And I had a whole thing in here, like the bios on these kids, but it was 3 pages long because there's 5 of them. But right. These essentially were local kids. They were all in their early 20s. Joseph was a kind of like a prize fighter and was pretty well known in Hawaii. And the other kids, like they all worked at a cannery after high school. They were just like young kids that were partying one night and then got into an almost car accident with the peoples and got into like a shoving match and a punching match with Mrs. Peoples, who, I mean, badass. She punched a prize fighter in the face after he hit her in the face. So, you know, but these were not criminals. These kids, like one of them had been charged with like a petty theft at one time. None of them had violent convictions. None of them had been charged with anything worse than like a misdemeanor. So the newspapers like went crazy and were like, they made shit up about these kids. They called one of them a convicted rapist. He had never even been charged with a sex crime.
Well, and they made shit up about Thalia too, having the highest character. I mean, be serious.
Yeah.
They did no research.
No. They did no research.
As the investigation developed, one glaring weakness in the prosecution case became obvious. It was hard to see how the suspects had the time to commit the alleged rapes. Witnesses placed the men at a dance in Waikiki until 2:05 or 2:10 a.m. They were back at the private home of a city supervisor, where a party had been in full swing earlier, by 12:30. The near accident with Agnes Peoples occurred at 12:40, at a location 6 miles from the scene of the alleged rapes. The Clarks picked up Thalia Massey between 12:50 and 1 a.m. How could the 5 young men drive across town after 12:40, pull Thalia into their car, then drag her out and rape her 6 or 7 times, while still leaving Thalia time to get up and flag down the car no later than 1 a.m.? The timeline didn't make sense. At the urging of Hawaii's Princess Kauananakoa, the last living symbol of Hawaii's former monarchy, William H. Heen, the only Democrat in the territory's Senate, agreed to meet with, and eventually to represent, the 5 young men accused in the Massey rape case. After interviewing the men, Heen and his co-counsel, William Pittman, felt certain their clients were innocent. The trial opened before Judge Alva Stedman in the Honolulu courthouse on November 16, 1931. 2 days later, prosecutors and defense attorneys settled on a jury of 7 non-whites, including 2 Chinese and 2 Japanese, and 5 whites. Thalia Massey took the witness stand first for the prosecution. In sometimes tearful testimony, Massey told jurors that she left the Alloway Inn about 11:35 and had walked 5 or 10 minutes along John Ina Road when she was picked up by the defendants. Quote, "Two men jumped out of the car," Massey testified, "and Joseph Kawahale came behind me and struck me on the jaw and was pushing me into the car," end quote. She estimated that she spent perhaps 20 minutes at the scene of her rape after being dragged out of the car. In cross-examination, Thalia failed to recall making statements to the effect that her attackers were all Hawaiians, or that she was unable to make identifications either of her attackers or the car's license plate because of the darkness. Dr. John Porter, the doctor who examined Massey after her alleged rape, was at best equivocal on key questions. In response to the prosecution's question of whether it was possible four or six men had sexual intercourse without showing any viable sperm, Porter answered, "It may or may not." Inspector John McIntosh provided jurors with an account of the prosecution's clinching evidence. Massey's recall of a license plate number that varied by only a single digit from the plate riding on the back of Horace Ida's car. The prosecution rested.
This is like a witch hunt.
Oh, it's fully a witch hunt. And I knew that there had always been some tension between the native people of Hawaii and white people, because white people came and overtook everything just like everywhere else. But I guess I didn't realize the level of racism. They talked a lot in my research about how concerned they were that they weren't going to get enough white people on the jury. The prosecution was very concerned that they had more non-white people on the jury than white people.
Right.
And they really worked hard to not have any Hawaiian people on the jury, but they failed.
Can you imagine what these boys are thinking? What the hell? We had this small-ish incident, mm-hmm. and now we're being charged with rape?
Rape.
Like, it's just insane. I can't imagine.
The Admiral of the fucking Navy is coming after them. Yeah. Everybody is coming after them. And they're like, we just got in a car accident and Joe was drunk as hell and punched a lady. He definitely should go to jail because he punched that old lady. They were at a luau before this happened. They were just having
some drinks, some dancing.
Yeah. Some little pig.
Enjoyment.
Pig action. Yeah.
Yeah.
Very sad. So, fearing a backlash, they were seen as too tough on Thalia Massey. Defense attorneys adopted a strategy of presenting evidence that the police got the wrong men, rather than that no rape had ever occurred. Any suggestion that Thalia's claim was fabricated had to be made with extreme subtlety. The attorneys hoped that the jurors themselves could be counted on to note the lack in the prosecution's case of significant medical evidence supporting the rape charge. And essentially, if you are gang raped, there is going to be serious and severe physical trauma. And they did not find that. Numerous alibi witnesses placed the defendants away from the scene of the alleged rape at critical times. Several witnesses testified that they saw the defendants at the Eagles Dance and the nearby parking lot around midnight. Others described seeing them en route to Sylvester Correa's home, where a luau had been in progress, in the minutes after the dance ended. Two Correa teenagers testified that they saw the defendants looking to see whether there was more beer in the family driveway sometime close to 12:30 a.m. With the earlier testimony in the prosecution case concerning the altercation with Agnes Peoples around 12:35 to 12:40, some jurors could be expected to begin having doubts about whether the defendants had the time for 20 minutes of gang rape in the hour between midnight and 1 a.m. These doubts likely increased when the defense produced witnesses who reported sightings of Thalia, or someone who wore Thalia's dress or looked a lot like Thalia, walking along John Ina Road shortly after midnight. A couple testified that while on foot in search of Japanese noodles, they saw a woman of Massey's height, followed by a white man, walking toward them. Both witnesses were quite sure the green ankle-length dress the woman had on was the same one Thalia wore on the night of the alleged rape. The wife told jurors that the woman they saw was mumbling and stumbling. Other witnesses raised questions about Thalia Massey's memory, which seemed to get better and better as the investigation proceeded. Detective George Harbottle, one of the first to interview Massey, testified that she first had said it had been too dark to identify her assailants and that she had failed to get a good look at the license plate number. Finally, defense attorneys Heen and Pittman raised questions about the integrity of the investigation itself. Most dramatically, an officer testified that he and Detective McIntosh had driven Horace Ida's car back and forth in the mud at the scene of the alleged rape at a time before the officer, who was the tire mark expert, had shown up to conduct his tire tread investigation. Closing arguments began on December 1st, 1931. For the defense, William Heen argued that the police witnesses for the prosecution had led and been caught red-handed in framing the tire evidence to send innocent men to jail. The evidence, Heen said, proved the defendants were nowhere near the site of the rape when it occurred, if it occurred at all. He urged jurors to be courageous and return a verdict of not guilty on your first ballot. Griffith White, for the prosecution, asked jurors to vindicate Hawaii and protect your women. The jury deliberated for 97 hours before finally giving up, unable to reach a verdict. The final vote, it was later revealed, was 6-6.
I feel like if I was the defense in this case, I would feel like I had fucking gone down the rabbit hole into Wonderland and was arguing with the Mad Hatter. Like, this is insane.
Yeah.
Insanity. I don't see how there is no way that they would not have found these kids innocent after listening to the defense.
I know. And it's one of those where if you're just even a little bit outside of this like crazy bubble, you're very able to see this is fucking nuts. You guys are all acting crazy. But I think they just got so wrapped up in this idea of this white woman having been attacked by these like crazed Hawaiian boys. You know, it's
right. And we're also looking at this with eyes that are in 2024 and that 1931, where the times were very different. I get that. But still, facts are facts, man.
Agreed.
Tensions rose after the hung jury. The shame of Honolulu, read one banner headline above a story that warned of the risk of rape by gangs of lust-mad youths. Youths!
Youths.
Police answered numerous riot calls after fights broke out between whites and non-whites. Defendant Horace Ida found a revolver stuck into his ribcage outside a speakeasy and was dragged into a car filled with sailors and taken to a remote cliffside location. The sailors dragged him from his car, removed his shirt, and proceeded to whip him, kick him, and slug him with a gun. A passing motorist discovered Ida and took the battered youth to the police station where he was pronounced, quote, lucky to be alive. Admiral Sterling called for a military takeover of Hawaii and canceled all shore leave for Navy personnel. Meanwhile, Grace Fortescue and Tommy Massey were not about to let this go, and they began plotting their own strategy for dealing with what they and their supporters considered to be a travesty of justice. They fretted that a second trial might produce no better outcome than the first. Police had uncovered no new evidence of guilt, and there seemed no obvious way to keep non-whites, who they suspected of having voted for acquittal in the first trial, off of a second jury. Only a confession could guarantee a guilty verdict. An attorney friend of the Masseys told Tommy that a confession made as the result of a beating would not be admissible. However, so long as a confession is extracted without force, or perhaps just so long as no bruises or marks are on the body, jurors could consider it, suggested the friend. Joe Kahahawe, according to rumors, might be the easiest defendant to crack. So Grace and Massey began to focus their scheme on him. Under a court order, Kahahawe was required to appear daily at 8 a.m. at the Judiciary Building in downtown Honolulu to meet with his probation officer. On Thursday morning, January 7, 1932, Tommy Massey, disguised in a gray chauffeur costume and goggles, drove in a rented Buick sedan to the Judiciary Building. Riding with Massey was a soldier, Deacon Jones, recruited for the plot. Grace and another sailor, Edward Lord, followed behind in Fortescue's roadster. When Kahahawe left the building following his meeting, Jones strode toward him, grabbed him by the arm, and waved a crude imitation of a military summons in his face. The paper, with its misspelling, read, Territorial Police, Major Ross commanding, summons to appear, Kahawe Joe. Pasted below that was random text from a newspaper, and in the corner of the absurd document, Grace had pasted a gold seal that was cut from a diploma Tommy had earned for completing chemical warfare school. God. Jeez. Us. Jones, with a Colt 32 to back him up, ordered Kahawe into the car and sped off. As the car turned right up King Street, a friend of Kahawe's, who witnessed the abduction, ran to report what had happened to officials in the Judiciary Building. Meanwhile, both of the conspirators' cars headed to Grace's rented home, Manoa Valley. Radio transmissions advised Honolulu police to be on the lookout for a blue Buick sedan believed to be involved in the Kahahawe kidnapping. At about 10:20 a.m., Detective George Harbottle spotted a large sedan driven by a woman with two male passengers and a drawn back shade. The drawn shade aroused suspicion, so Harbottle decided to investigate. The detective followed the car as it headed out along Coastline Road in the direction of a steep cliff overlooking the Halona blowhole. The car picked up speed. Soon, another police car joined the chase. The driver of the Buick ignored Harbottle's orders to pull over. Harbottle fired shots at the vehicle as it sped past. Finally, the detective managed to overtake the fleeing car and force it off the road. With gun drawn, Harbottle approached the car. In the rear seat, the detective saw a blood-soaked bedsheet wrapped around a body. He placed under arrest the occupants of the car: Grace Fortescue, Tommy Massey, and Edward Lord. Well, 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 boys.
And mother of Thalia, who was the fucking mastermind behind this batshit hijinks gone wrong. I mean, this society woman and this man who is in the Navy disguised as a chauffeur, arts and crafts together, this fake fucking summons, and then abduct a guy from the courthouse steps in broad daylight in the middle of town.
This was a hijinks, if there ever was one.
It was a terrible, terrible plan. These people are idiots.
Idiot sandwich.
Yeah. All right, so investigators arrived at the rented house that Grace Fortescue had been staying in while she was there for Thalia's rape trial. They went there and were greeted by Deacon Jones, who was holding a glass of whiskey. Officers brought Jones to the police station for questioning. They also gathered evidence, including rope, guns, masquerade outfits, buttons that had been ripped from underclothing, and a blood-soaked towel. Admiral Sterling, aghast to think of Grace or his soldiers spending even a single night in jail, secured judicial approval to house the four prisoners at a decommissioned ship in Pearl Harbor. Messages of sympathy and support poured in as the four conspirators enjoyed the luxury accommodations provided by the United States Navy. Some newspaper reports around the country referred to the murder as an honor killing.
Ew.
Mm-hmm. In an increasingly divided Hawaii, more mourners showed up for the funeral of Joe Kahahawai than any other in the island's history, except for the funeral 15 years earlier of its last queen. Among the 2,000 people attending the ceremonies, one remark was heard most frequently: Joe's death proved that whites are, quote, shameless. The islands had witnessed a lynching, not an honor killing. On January 21st, a grand jury convened to consider whether to indict Grace Fortescue, Thomas Massey, Deacon Jones, and Edward Lord for the kidnapping and murder of Joe Kahawe. For 2 days, the 21 grand jurors listened as County Attorney Griffith White presented witnesses. The majority of the jurors seemed inclined not to indict and probably would not have done so, but for the determined efforts of Judge Albert Christie, who is a fucking badass, and we love Judge Christie. We love this dude, way ahead of his time. Judge Christie reminded grand jurors that their job differed from that of a trial jury. They were not to make conclusions about guilt or innocence, but rather to determine whether there was enough credible evidence of guilt to justify putting the defendants on trial. When the jury foreman reported back to the judge, the jury stood 12-9 against indictment. Christie hauled their asses back into the courtroom for another lecture on the function of a grand jury. He told them to ignore their inner feelings and return an indictment if the evidence showed a crime was committed and that these defendants were responsible. Jurors who could not do their duty, the judge suggested, should resign immediately. 3 days later, as deliberations resumed, the judge asked the grand jurors to lay aside all race prejudice and consider how civilization depends for its very existence on the rule of law. Eventually, the jurors came around to seeing it Christie's way. By a vote of 12-8, the grand jury finally voted to indict all four defendants for second-degree murder.
At the time the grand jury returned its indictments, America's most famous defense attorney, Clarence Darrow, was 75 and some 7 years into his retirement. The Depression, however, had taken a toll on the investments that he and his wife Ruby assumed would guarantee them golden years of European travel and fine living. Darrow attributed his decision to take the case, for the then princely sum of $30,000 plus expenses, to his need for money, his longing to see Hawaii, and his interest in cases that raised profound issues of psychology. It was beyond dispute that the four defendants had caused the death of Joe Kahahawe, so Darrow was left to consider what extenuating circumstances would be most likely to turn a jury toward acquittal. Temporary insanity seemed a promising idea. Darrow arranged for a team of prominent psychiatrists to travel from the mainland to meet with his clients. The prosecutor assigned to the case, John C. Kelly, understood that under a felony murder theory, he did not have to prove which of the four defendants fired the bullet that killed Kahahawe. He suspected Jones, but it didn't matter. If any one of the four was the killer, then all four involved in the kidnap plot were equally guilty. Kelly knew Darrow to be a flamboyant, instinctual courtroom lawyer who often had little patience for statutes and case law. He suspected that Darrow would try to convince jurors that the unwritten law justified the actions of his clients. In his opening statement for the prosecution, John Kelly told jurors the evidence would prove that Kahawe was shot, then dragged to a bathroom where he bled to death. Kelly then called his first witness, Edward Uli, who described the abduction. He identified Deacon Jones and Grace Fortescue as among those who he saw kidnap his cousin after they walked out of the judiciary building. Skipping for now the murder, Kelly next presented witnesses who described the capture of the defendants. Detective Harbottle identified the three people he found in the Buick. Other police officers identified incriminating evidence found in the car, including a bloodstained shirt with a bullet hole in its left side. Kelly held up the shirt and then gave it to the jury foreman. As each juror, in turn, examined the shirt, Joe Kahawe's mother, seated near the jurors, wept openly. Moving on to the murder itself, Kelly presented the coroner with a full-color set of anatomical drawings that made clear that Kahawe had been sitting down and his killer standing at the time of his shooting. Photos of Grace's bloodstained floors were introduced into evidence. Detectives reported finding rope matching that found on Kahawe's corpse, and then Kelly passed to the jurors the actual rope found on the body. Bloody sheets were held up for jurors to see. Detective Arthur Stagbar told jurors how he found buttons that matched the buttons on Kahawe's shirt underneath Fortescue's wash bin. A gun salesman testified that the bullet removed from Kahawe's body matched an empty cartridge found in the pocket of Deacon Jones, and that the bullet could have been fired from the .32 caliber Colt he had sold to Jones. The evidence of guilt seemed overwhelming. Kelly rested his case after calling Joe Kahawe's mother to the stand to identify her son's clothing.
Oh, it's heartbreaking.
I know. To be this kid's mom and hear people, especially this incredibly famous lawyer, Clarence Darrow, was when he showed up in Hawaii, they essentially had a parade for him, a boat parade. It was a... You know when they do like cruise send-offs or cruise come
yeah.
back and people? I mean, there were people like lined up on the streets waving as he and his wife were rowed in an antique boat. They were given lays and stuff. I mean, it was just, it was such a fucking circus. And this woman is like, they fucking killed my kid. They kidnapped yeah. him and they killed him. But sure, give him a fucking lay necklace. That's fine. Whatever. Give him a necklace. Give the racist a necklace from my people.
No.
Asshole. All right. The defense calls Lieutenant Thomas H. Massey. So Massey took the stand as Darrow's first witness. He asked him about the night of September 12th and asked him if he remembered going to the dancer party. And Massey launched into a narrative about the events leading to the alleged rape of his wife. Kelly objected, arguing that the Ala Moana case was relevant only if it caused the insanity of one of the defendants. This is exactly what I hope to prove, Darrow announced, adding that if the one who shot the pistol was insane, all the defendants should be equally innocent. Judge Davis allowed Darrow to proceed with his line of questioning. Massey described the agony caused by his failure to protect his wife from a rape in which Kahahoe was supposedly the most brutal of brutal gang rapists. He testified, as he held Thalia after her ordeal, she cried, quote, "I want to die, I hope to die," unquote. In the nights that followed, Massey said his wife would rouse from her sleep, shouting, "Don't let him get me." His wife's distress led to his own set of problems, weight loss, sleep loss, and fear that his wife might become diseased or pregnant as a result of the attack. His last fear was realized, Tommy told jurors. The couple decided to abort her pregnancy. "I took her to the hospital, and Dr. Withington performed the operation," he said. Women in the courtroom dabbed their eyes with handkerchiefs as Massey ended his testimony for the day. And side note, how the hell does he know whose baby that was?
He doesn't.
And newsflash, she wasn't raped. So it was probably his baby. Fucking dummy. After court was canceled the next day because Darrow was too hungover to attend, he claimed that he had an attack of the gastritis. Tommy resumed his testimony. Darrow's questions took his witness to the murder scene. Tommy described seating Kahahoe in Grace's living room and then picking up the .32 automatic owned by Deacon Jones. The witness told jurors that Kahahoe continued to maintain his innocence in the face of his barrage of questions until he finally broke. And Tommy said that he had said, quote, "Now go ahead and tell the whole story. You know your gang was there," unquote. And suddenly Joe Kahahoe said, quote, "Yes, we done it." Tommy said the last thing he remembers was that picture that came into his mind of his wife when he assaulted her, and she prayed for mercy, and he answered with a blow that broke her jaw. He testified that he remembered having a gun in his hand but did not remember shooting anyone. Darrow's two psychiatric experts testified Tommy was temporarily insane at the time of the shooting. One expert explained that the strain of his wife's misfortune and the trigger of Kahahoe's confession caused Tommy to suffer an impaired state of consciousness and lapse into a reflexive, automatic pattern of action. The other expert suggested the strain of recent events had caused Tommy's ductless glands to alter his body chemistry. Chemical insanity was the doctor's diagnosis. What horseshit is this?
Horseshit. It's a lot of horseshit. Well, and if they kidnapped him, and if there was a felony committed, a murder committed in the progress of another crime, then everybody is guilty. It doesn't matter if he's insane or not. I mean, this defense is crazy.
Well, I mean, you have to think, like, Darrow, it is an interesting argument to make. Like, he can't say, there's too much evidence for him to say, no, they absolutely didn't do it. Like, he had to come up with something.
A reason why.
Yeah, and this is an interesting, and you'll see at the end why, but this is, like, a very interesting strategy that he tries to pull off here, because it's just enough in a gray area where people are like, huh, there's not a precedent for it.
Right.
Like, if one person is insane, then everybody else is innocent. I don't know. Well,
right. It's crazy. Yeah. I don't know. That's always so interesting to me, is how they come up with defense sometime.
Yeah.
Darrow called Thalia Massey to the stand. Thalia offered a new, more detailed version of the alleged rape, in which Kahahoe refused her request to pray and then, quote, "hit me as hard as he could in the jaw," end quote. When she pleaded, quote, "please do not hit me anymore," Kahahoe, according to her, replied, "well, shut up then," and swore at her. Thalia testified that she learned about Kahawe's murder from Deacon Jones. After telling her the news, according to Thalia, quote, "he asked me for a drink, and I poured him one, but he said, that's not enough, so I filled his glass," end quote. Many spectators cried during Thalia's emotional testimony. Darrow, however, was worried. He noticed that two jurors were dry-eyed and cleaning their nails. The highest drama of the trial played out during John Kelly's cross-examination of Thalia Massey. When Kelly handed Thalia a psychiatric questionnaire she had filled out some years earlier, one that suggested serious marital problems, the witness snapped, quote, "Where did you get this? Don't you know this is a confidential communication between a doctor and a patient? I refuse to say whether this is my handwriting or not," end quote. Thalia proceeded to tear the questionnaire in two and then ripped it into smaller pieces, finally tossing the shreds into the air. Spectators erupted in applause. Quote, "Thank you, Mrs. Massey. At last you've shown your true colors," Kelly remarked. Thalia almost stumbled from the witness stand into the arms of her husband, who had moved forward to catch her. With her arms firmly around her husband, Thalia shouted hysterically, quote, "What right has he to say that I don't love you? Everybody knows I love you," end quote. Even Clarence Darrow seemed stunned by what he just witnessed. Quote, "I've seen some pretty good court scenes, but nothing like that one." The defense rested. After rebuttal testimony from a pair of psychiatrists testifying for the prosecution, unsurprisingly, they declared Thomas Massey perfectly sane at the time of the murder, summations began. Clarence Darrow's last argument was carried live on radio stations across the country. Every seat in the hushed courtroom was filled as Darrow recounted how the unbearable suffering of the Masseys had driven Grace Fortescue to extreme action in defense of her loved one. For over 4 hours, Darrow's voice rose and sank. His hands waved through the sultry courtroom air. He bent and straightened and occasionally wiped away tears. He emphasized the injustice of closing, quote, "the black gates of prison, of a prison," end quote, on his clients, on top of all they have suffered. After a lunch recess, Darrow moved toward his conclusion. "If you want to send Grace to the penitentiary, all right, go to it. If this wife and mother, this husband and these faithful boys go to the penitentiary, it won't be the first time the penitentiary has been sanctified by its inmates. It won't be the first time the name of the jail will be remembered when every jailer has been forgotten. When people come here, the first thing they will wish to see is where the mother and husband are confined. If it should happen, that building will be the most conspicuous building on this island, and people will wonder at the cruelty and injustice of man." He praised Hawaii, quote, "this fairyland with its green mountains and its ocean waves that turn to every hue of the rainbow, and its kindly dispositioned people," end quote. He ended with a plea for mercy, quote, "I ask you to be kind, understanding, considerate, both to the living and the dead," end quote. Oh my God, the drama.
I know.
I don't think they've made a movie or a miniseries about this because people would be like, oh, Jesus, what is this?
I know. I think it's added for me because I'm thinking about it like, okay, this was in the 1930s. Everybody's very dressed up. They all have hats and gloves on. And, yes. You know, it's this, you know, it's not like today where people would be like in jean shorts and flip-flops.
Like a whole occasion. It's like a show. Yeah.
Yes. I don't know. It's much ratcheted up for some reason. But it is, it's like a rich version of a hillbilly. I don't know. I don't know where to go with that. All right. On April 27th, after listening to Judge Davis's detailed instruction, the jury settled into its deliberation. 47 hours worth of debates later, the jury still had not reached a verdict, and Judge Davis called them back into the courtroom. "Is there any possibility of arriving at a verdict in the near future?" the judge asked the jury foreman. To the surprise of most observers, the foreman said he thought a verdict might be reached. The jury returned to its room. 30 minutes later, the announcement came. A verdict had been reached in the Massey case. After reporters and attorneys and defendants reassembled, the verdict sheets were read by the clerk of court. For each defendant, the same words came. Guilty of manslaughter, leniency recommended. So the jury asked for leniency for the four defendants, and that's what they got. Navy brass and powerful business figures in the states were demanding full pardons for all. Judd, however, felt pressure not to be seen as condoning lynching, a perception which would outrage important groups in his state. Then, according to defense attorneys who at the time were with Judd in his office discussing options, his phone rang. On the other end of the line was President Herbert Hoover, who urged Judge to avoid jail time for the four. Which, fuck you, Hoover. Yeah. Really?
Word.
Without explanation, sentencing in the case was moved up 2 days to the following morning, which was May 4th. As the bailiff ordered each defendant to stand in turn, Judge Davis imposed sentences on each, 10 years imprisonment at hard labor, which, good for you, dude, right?
Yeah.
Way to not bow to the pressure. But court adjourned, and the sheriff took custody of the four prisoners and led them on a walk to the governor's office. A few minutes later, Judd read a short statement to reporters who had been summoned to his office, and there are photos of this. And he said, quote, "I hereby announce I have commuted their sentence to 1 hour to be served in the custody of the high sheriff." Grace Fortescue then turned to the governor and said, quote, "This is the happiest day of my life," end quote. Deacon Jones left to send a telegram to his mother in Massachusetts that read, "Dear Mom, we'll be home soon. Keep the coffee hot. Albert." Princess Kauana Anakoa spoke for many less powerful and less white voices in Hawaii. She said, quote, "Are we to infer from the governor's act that there are two sets of laws in Hawaii, one for the favored few and one for the people generally," unquote. The governor seemed to have second thoughts about his commutation. He refused all demands for a full pardon and wrote a letter to the Secretary of Interior, blasting Navy officials for their racist attitudes and requesting a reassignment, which was granted, of Admiral Sterling. In October, the Pinkerton Detective Agency handed Governor Judd a 279-page report of the Massey case. The report concluded, quote, "It is impossible to escape the conclusion that the kidnapping and assault was not caused by those accused." Later, John Kelly announced that all rape charges were being dropped against the Ala Moana defendants. So they didn't retry them. Thalia never seemed to be able to control the mental instability she had revealed during the 1932 trial of her husband and mother. Her self-serving version of events implicated five men in a crime they could not have committed. One of the men was killed as a result, and the others never fully escaped the shadow of the trial. When investigating Pinkerton detectives reported that the accused young men were undeniably innocent, Thalia rejected their findings, stating, quote, "It's a lie and a stupid lie," end quote. She never exhibited any remorse or discussed the possibility that she had identified the wrong men. Another failed marriage and a number of suicide attempts later, Thalia finally overdosed on barbiturates in her Palm Beach, Florida home in 1963. And can I just say, aloha, bitch.
Aloha, bitch.
Yeah.
We need that made into a t-shirt, TM.
Yeah.
It's such a sad, sad story.
I know. The fact that these white convicted felons were walked from the courthouse after being sentenced to 10 years of hard labor to the governor's office, where he commuted their sentences to 1 hour after they had just been convicted of murdering someone. And this was not second-degree murder. They made a fake summons. They had costumes. This was not some, like, whoopsie situation. It's...
it's a slap in the face to everybody involved. It's really disheartening. I cannot imagine.
Yeah. No. And it just showed all of the people in Hawaii that they didn't give a fuck. They did not care. This woman was proven to be a fucking liar And I don't know. I looked to see if anybody found out what really happened that night to Thalia, because something happened because her face was all fucked up.
Right.
But my guess is that she, because she was always so belligerent and hitting people, my guess is that she hit somebody and they hit her back in the face. And she was embarrassed and shit-faced and walking along a road and just made this thing up because she was upset her husband hadn't paid attention to her at the bar. Yeah, and that he was going to find out that she was not obeying his contract rules and he was going to send her ass back to her mother. So she's like, he better not find out that I got into another physical altercation with someone.
Yeah. I think you're onto something there.
I know. So we're going to talk about what really happened the night that Joseph Kahanaway was murdered. Well, actually the morning, because it was like 9 a.m. Because that's when you kidnap someone, you know? So 30 years after his murder, an author named Peter Van Slingerland was writing a book about this case called Something Terrible Has Happened. During his research, he interviewed Deacon Jones, who was one of the sailors that had been roped into this stupid fucking plan. So Jones sits down with this writer and he recounted how the plan was they had all gone to the courthouse the morning of the abduction and he brought his gun with him. And he said he didn't think Tommy had a gun and he didn't think anybody else had a gun. He thought he was the only one who had a gun. And he described Grace as a pretty smooth woman and that her plan had been to psychologically fuck with Joseph until he admitted what he had done to Thalia. That was the plan. So he's standing outside of the courtroom for a few minutes and Joseph comes out of the courthouse and he shows him this bogus summons that they had made and kind of just grabs him and throws him into the back of this car. And they drive to the rental house that Grace Fortescue was living in. And they go in through the back door. And he says at this point, it's just he and Tommy. Grace and the other naval officer had not arrived at the house yet. So it was just he and Tommy and Joseph. And he says Tommy sits Joseph down on this couch. And then he sits down in front of him in a chair. And he just sort of starts interrogating him. And while Tommy's interrogating him, Deacon Jones has the gun pointed at Joseph. And he's like, why did you beat up my wife? And, you know, just like over and over and over. And the author asks Deacon, the fuck is his name? Deacon. The author asked Deacon Jones what Kahanaway's response to the questioning was. And so we're going to read through this bit of back and forth. And so, Cam, I'm going to be Jones and you're going to be the writer. Okay.
Okay.
So Jones says he was scared. He was scared almost white. Let's put it this way. Supposing you and me are sitting here and we got and I'm not going to say the word that he used, but it's the word that an absolute racist monster would use in describing someone with dark skin. Sitting right there and I got a gun. He's going to be scared, isn't he? Unless he's a goddamn fool. And this guy was no fool. Then as this little set two kept going along, he started getting his nerve back. He was just going to run a bluff. You could almost see it in his attitude. It changed from fear to kind of overbearing. I suppose he was thinking what he would do to either one of us if he could get us alone.
You say Massey was questioning him. Then what happened?
Massey asked him a question and Kahanaway lunged at him. I say lunged. Somebody else might say he just leaned forward.
And then?
I shot him.
You shot him?
You're goddamn right I did. I shot him right underneath the left nipple into the side. When that slug hit him, he just went over backwards on the chase lounge. The bullet didn't go through him. It stayed in his body. That was a climax right there.
Did you know what you were doing?
When I shot that son of a bitch, I knew what I was doing.
How did you feel then?
When that shot was fired, it had completely gone out of our hands. We were in a peck of trouble, and we knew it.
How long after you arrived in the house was this?
Maybe 8 minutes.
How much blood was there?
Oh, just a little trickle.
Where was Mrs. Fortescue and
Lord? The last guy's name was Lord.
Oh, yeah. And Lord when the shot was fired.
Just as we killed this joker, in they come. Obviously, they had heard the shot. They were that close. I guess there was maybe a lapse of a minute at the very most.
What was Mrs. Fortescue's reaction?
She was a scared woman. I think she took a hold of Tommy and hugged him. You know, she liked Tommy.
Then what happened?
I don't know why, but it was my suggestion to put him in the bathtub. Of course, the way I was thinking then, I was frightened, excited, all that. Well, goddammit, it's easier to clean a tile bathtub than a rug. I was scared. God bless my soul. After that, Kanaka was dead, and that's what white people used to call Native Hawaiians, because they're fucking assholes. We had 170 pounds of carcass on our hands. So Eddie and I put him in the bathtub, and we turned the water on. I had the asinine thought that the water would pull the blood out of him.
Did Mrs. Fortescue come in the bathroom with you?
She was standing at the door when we put him in the tub. We told her to shove off because we was going to undress him. We were all excited. I think Eddie said, "Mrs. Fortescue, get the hell out of here." We had this joker in the bathtub. The water was on. I don't know why, but we were going to undress him. We had his pants down, trying to get them off his feet. He was exposed.
Tommy was in the bathroom too?
Yes.
What was his reaction?
You know, I'd never killed a man before, believe me. Now, Tommy, of course, was a brilliantly educated boy. I was just an ordinary, everyday seaman. Maybe this was to boost my own ego, or maybe I said it to quiet things down, but I said to Mr. Massey, "For Christ's sake, didn't you ever kill a man before?" He said, "No, Jones, I never did." Well, I hadn't either, but I was going to be something I wasn't. So that's the end of the back and forth. Once these group of fucking idiots in the bathroom were done bathing him, I don't think they even knew what they were doing. They wrapped his body up in a sheet and took it out to the car. So Tommy, Eddie Lord, and Grace Fortescue got in the car with the body, and Tommy tells Deacon Jones to go to his house and sit with Thalia. The police eventually make a couple of visits back and forth to the Massey home that day after they had caught the three after the high-speed chase in the car. And on the second visit, they go ahead and arrest Deacon Jones because they're like, this guy's obviously part of this. And in his interview with this author, he's very nonchalant about the fact that he had murdered this guy. He was like, he slept really, really well that night in the pokey. That's what he said. I slept really well in the pokey that night. And the most interesting thing about this whole revelation 30 years later is that when asked in his interview if Clarence Darrow knew what had really happened, Deacon Jones says, yes. He told Darrow during the trial, like the last couple days of the trial, that he had been the one to shoot Kahahaway. Darrow continued with the storyline that Massey had been the shooter, even though he knew that Deacon Jones had shot him. And Jones ended his interview saying, quote, "I didn't think nothing of it. I figured the hell with it. That seemed to me Mr. Darrow's idea to let Tommy take the rap, because if it had been either Lord or I that was up there, they'd say, what in the hell was he doing in it anyway? But Tommy had a motive and the reason. After all, it was his wife." End quote.
So fucked up.
Uh-huh.
Ugh, there's a special place in hell.
Yeah. And this whole interview was just peppered with racist, disgusting garbage.
Oh, I'm sure. He's pretty proud of himself, it seems. No shame.
No. And, you know, I always wonder, like, how you bring people in. How'd they decide on these two, like, random seamen to have them come into the plan? Like, Tommy was a naval officer. Like, he wasn't just petty officer. He was high up there. So how are you like, which two fucking degenerate sailors are we going to get to join in on our costume party that we're having?
Costume party. I don't know. I'm sure he knew them. Gross.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, that was depressing. So
it was totally depressing. I know. Thalia and Tommy moved. I think he got transferred to like Arizona or something. They got divorced. Thalia remarried a couple different times, got addicted to barbiturates, totally wasted life, essentially. And then she died pretty young.
Yeah, it does seem like a really wasted life.
Yeah.
Well, good riddance.
That's what I thought. Yep. I love Hawaii.
I love Hawaii too. Me too.
It's my favorite place to go, I think.
It's so beautiful.
Mm-hmm. I know, you know, I've been to Hawaii many times, and we went to Honolulu when I was young, but that's the only time I've been to Honolulu. Usually we go to Maui or we go to Kauai or the Big Island. Russ's family is from the Big Island, but I've never been, and you know what a history buff I am, I've never been to Pearl Harbor. And that's right. One of my, like, I really want to go to Pearl Harbor, but I want to wait until the kids are old enough. I mean, Tucker would be totally into it. He would love it, but I don't want to go and listen to Poppy be like, this is so boring.
Yeah.
Or we just have to wait a few years until she would not think it was the worst, but because I really want to go.
Yeah. It would be super interesting.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that's the story of a batshit crazy white lady who needed a lot of attention. Well, she was actually a teenager, let's be clear. And her merry band of idiots.
Truly.
And our sad, sad, depressing trip to Hawaii. We hoped you enjoyed hanging out with us.
Yes, we do. And we will be back in 2 weeks with I don't know what yet, because we haven't even discussed what the next episode is going to be, but we'll figure it out and give you a good story. And have a great week. I don't know.
Keep your pants on.
Yeah.